Hey guys, welcome back to the podcast. I'm Em, and today I'm chatting with Nadine Baggett.
Don't be afraid to jump, even if you can't see what you're jumping into. It's genuinely never too late. I'm living proof. I wish more people in their 60s and 70s who are older than me would just start creating content. I find it incredibly empowering.
If you guys don't already know Nadine, she is the UK's online beauty authority, TV presenter, and former health and beauty journalist with 30 years experience writing for the Saturday Times, Hello, the Daily Mail, and Marie Claire. Nadine is such the inspo, you guys. Transitioning from traditional journalism to being a full-blown YouTuber and influencer at age 60. She really is the example of it's never too late to create your online platform. Nadine shares her experience on how she got here, as well as the future of video media, why niche expertise is the future, and of course, her top budget-friendly and anti-aging skincare and beauty picks. Anyway, Nadine is sharing it all, so let's jump right into the episode. Nadine, hi, and welcome to the Big Move podcast.
Thank you very much for asking me to be on.
We're so pleased to have you on. We have so much to get through and cover with you, so we're literally going to dive right in. Do you mind just giving our audience a background on who you are, what you're all about?
So I joke these days that I'm the oldest influencer in town, and to a degree I am, seriously, because I have been a health and beauty journalist for 32 years, 33 years this year. I started in a very traditional role as a journalist on a magazine, decided in those days of open offices, looking over sort of those little barriers. I'm very tall and thinking that department's having more fun than I am as a journalist, as a features journalist. I want to work in that department. And it was the health and beauty journalism department. So for me, it was the perfect blend of art and science, which I've always thought about beauty. I started in women's magazines. I worked my way up to from fairly middle market magazines to Marie Claire, worked from Marie Claire onto newspapers. I worked for the Daily Mail before it was online and had the platform it has now. I, at that time, went into do television. I then went to Hello Magazine. And as I saw traditional legacy media start to contract, I thought, what can I do to keep my voice? And that's when I started my Instagram and my YouTube. And although I still work for the Times as a journalist, I'm mainly a digital content creator now. And the oldest one in town.
No, I love it. And thank you so much for the breakdown. I'm fascinated, by the way, from your trajectory from like more traditional journalism into more digital. And we have so many questions around that we're going to get into. But I guess to back up a little bit on this show, I love to hone in on our guests' big moves. So whether it's moving cities or countries or taking a big risk in your career, those big life transitions that kind of shape our stories. Is there one big move in particular that comes to mind that you would want to share with us today?
For me, I'm quite averse to change. I don't really like change. I'm not a hare in the race. I'm the turtle, sort of the tortoise going along quite slowly. So the big moves I've had, which have been really fortuitous, have kind of been foisted upon me. So I have three in my career. Being forced to become self-employed when I was made redundant, which was, at the time felt terrible and then became the best thing that ever happened to me. Landing a gig on TV because TV companies are notoriously cheap and wanted to steal my ideas off magazines. And then the third one was more recently starting my YouTube channel at the age of 54 because I had no desire to do it really. I just felt like legacy media was contracting and I was going to lose my voice. So let's be honest here. I'm not jumping out of a plane without a parachute. I'm being pushed out and then learning to fly. That's my motto. I'm not a natural risk taker. But actually being forced to take risks have been absolutely the key to my career's success.
Love that. And I give you so much kudos, by the way. It's like, I can't even get my YouTube off the ground. And here you are at 54, you know, launching and flourishing, obviously. And we have more questions on your YouTube, by the way. So thank you for sharing that. I guess to back up, so where did your career in journalism really start for you? Can you kind of set the stage there?
So I left university with what is known as a modular degree, which means I was unlike the generation today who are forced to decide what they want to be when they're sort of, you know, 9 or 10. I graduated at 21, not really knowing what I wanted to do. I'd started off as a science degree, and I actually do have a BSc, and then realized actually that I probably preferred the social sciences. So I graduated, and at the time, which actually was the mid-80s, the only way you could really get a job that was remotely interesting was to sort of, you know, put yourself into a temp agency. And I went to a temp agency, lied my way into the temp agency, said I had all these secretarial skills. I was a complete liability and absolutely useless. Ended up working on a magazine for a publisher who realized pretty quickly that I couldn't file and I couldn't type and I couldn't do any of those things. But actually, I was pretty handy in the editorial department. So in those days, the unions used to run a lot of journalism. So they had to send me back to university. They sent me back for a postgraduate diploma in journalism, which is where I truly found my passion and my love. And then I came back. And then about 3 years later, I repaid them by moving into women's magazines, because you've got to realize in sort of 88, 89, this was when women's magazines were truly at their peak. I mean, when Marie Claire was launched and Elle was launched, it was the dream for any young, dynamic woman working in London to work on those magazines. And I am truly blessed that I lived and worked through magazines at their zenith. It was incredible. It was such a magical time.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was sort of in the 90s, you were working at a range of different publications. Is there a piece that you worked on that was most memorable for you, or that went viral, or something that you're really proud of that you would want to share?
Again, I have two moments where I thought, oh, I might actually be quite good at this. And the thing about working in women's magazines is, and do you know, funnily enough, I was in France last week with a group of journalists. You'll always be fed the culture of, if you don't want to do this, there's somebody younger, hungrier, who'll do it for less money. So you're never actually being given that much positive feedback. They like to keep you in your place because it's such a prestigious career. And it was just a sort of, you know, a culture that we all accepted. But I remember two key moments. I remember going to something called the Jasmine Awards, and I don't know if you're aware of them. They still happen today. I was at Marie Claire Health and Beauty. I, funnily enough, for somebody who's so healthy, I had a similar virus to you probably hear in the back of my voice now. I was quite unwell, and I was shortlisted for a Jasmine Award, and I was on Marie Claire Health and Beauty, and technically a nobody in this industry. There were some serious big players, and I knew I was up against them, and I sort of scraped my hair back, and I didn't have much makeup on, and I was sitting at the Jasmine Awards a little bit wide-eyed, surrounded by all these incredible writers from Vogue and Harper's and Elle and Marie Claire, and I was shortlisted, and then I got up on stage and won, and I remember looking around thinking, me? Are you sure? Me? And then I also remember a moment when I was made redundant and in those days, you had to send your copy over by fax. God, yes, I'm that old. And I got home and bearing in mind, I'd just been made redundant and my boyfriend was doing a degree at university. So I was the primary wage earner. And I remember getting an answering machine message, which I wish I'd kept. It was on one of those little tiny tapes that said, "Hi, Nadine. This is the Daily Mail. We have your feature that you wrote for us. I know we said that we wouldn't pay you until we saw it and it was any good. We think it's the best beauty copy we've ever read. You can write whatever you want from now on." And they were the moments where the first two moments in my career where I thought, oh, I might be quite good at this, simply because I had some positive feedback. So I'm not sure it's viral in the sense that you mean the term modern, you mean in the terms of being viral today. But for me, it was key to... You have to have some positive feedback to say to somebody, you know, I think you could be quite good at this.
Absolutely. Such a proud major moment. I mean, the Daily Mail is massive. And as you said, right now, and especially on the digital side of things. But yeah, I mean, that's huge.
No, I was going to say, and the important thing was, as being the primary wage earner for me, to go from a magazine where you would maybe write one or two features a month, I was suddenly writing three or four features a week. So I was kept really busy. And I have to say, and this is no disregard to absolutely any magazine out there and newspapers where you truly learn to become a journalist. You know, learning to edit your words, to not make your copy about you, to not seem in any way verbose or overly wordy, but to keep things short, sharp, and to the point. That teaches you to be a real journalist and to work on very tough deadlines.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great tangible tip too. I feel like that people could take away, you know, just with the digital age as well, like keep it straight and to the point.
My content is very rarely about me. It's educational and informative, yeah. And that's what I want.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I know that you have so much TV experience as well as a TV presenter. I'd love to dig in a little bit into your experience here. What did sort of being in front of a camera teach you from a career perspective? I feel like it takes so much confidence and poise, but I'd love to hear from you on that.
As I hinted at the top of the show, what happened was TV companies sound very glamorous, but they are notoriously cheap and they're put together on a budget. And if they want a segment and they don't have an expert, they often go through magazines, and nowadays they'll go to influencers, and they'll see the content they like, and they could be, you know, incredibly rude and steal your idea. But if they're really smart, what they do is they used to ring up the press office of the magazine or the newspaper and say, we saw this article in this magazine. Would the journalist come on and present the item? And so basically they just lift the whole idea. So it could be, I don't know, just off the top of my head, it could be, you know, five best budget vitamin C serums. In those days, it would have been something a lot more basic. But and so I just got this call one day going, do you want to do TV? And I'm Bethany Frankel. I come from a place of yes. I'm like, yeah, I want to do it. And luckily enough, it was in the early days of digital TV. So probably three people and my mum were watching, right? So I learned along with the expansion of TV. So I was really lucky to make all my big mistakes in the early days. I mean, somewhere, I'm about to move house, and somewhere is, I'm this old, is a trunk of Beta tapes and VHS tapes with all of my hideous mistakes on them. And I should really edit them all together and just do a massive blooper reel. So when people say to me now, you're so natural on camera, genuinely, it's just the experience of doing it for the better part of 25 years. Yeah. It teaches you that the camera magnifies everything you do. You can't really lie successfully on camera. You can only be yourself. So I can't be anything that I'm not. I have to accept who I am. You have to accept that you might not like your voice or the way you look. And so it has to go beyond that to just being authentic and informative. And hopefully fun for me. That's all I want. That's all I took away from and doing TV. And then further down the line, when I started my YouTube channel, it sounds like a really big deal for a woman of my age, but actually, short of the technicalities of learning how to light myself and sound myself and edit myself and all that stuff, I was pretty comfortable in front of the camera anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, probably bodes so well for what you're doing now. And I suppose too, like, I mean, your advice is simple, like just be you. But I feel like that also translates to all of the digital platforms right now. Like just be yourself. Otherwise, it's going to come off otherwise.
And you know what? It's one of the things that's really interesting is behind the scenes, I do some media training for people because I think nowadays everybody has to be comfortable in front of the camera. 20 years ago, it was such a rare experience. Now, MDs and dermatologists and makeup artists and hairstylists, they all have to be in front of the camera. And the first thing I need to say to people is simply sit in front of a camera, talk, do your job, watch yourself back. You'll start to notice really quickly, even the most simple things like, you know, not looking into the camera and maybe looking to one side makes you look shifty and things like that. It's practice makes perfect. It's such a cliche, but it's true, Emily.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes so much sense, but it's a unique perspective to hear it from you with so many years of experience. So I know you've spoken with some of the top experts, celebrities, beauty founders in the industry. I saw Drew Barrymore and you were on your YouTube channel recently. I guess what have been a couple of your most memorable interviews or people that you've gotten to speak with through the years?
I can remember the two moments when I completely lost it and was starstruck, which was really embarrassing. I am a huge Beyonce fan, and I got to meet Beyonce a very long time ago when she was the face of Tommy Hilfiger. And the most embarrassing moment was that the photographer had disappeared. He'd obviously just gone to the toilet or something, and he had to come back. So I was alone with her for about 5 minutes while they were trying to find the photographer. And I was so nervous, and I'm still totally in awe of that woman. So I just gabbled to fill the space. And so I am old enough to be her mother, and basically she's the adult in this room, trust me. And at one point she said to me something about liking the jeans I had on. And I said to her, I cannot believe I said this to her. And I said to her, oh, thank you. They're from Selfridges, which is just around the corner from where you're staying. And if they look good on me, they'll look good on you because I've got a big bottom too.
I love it.
Oh my God. And I meant it in the best possible way. I was also completely starstruck when I met Jane Fonda backstage at TV, and I completely fangirled her. But the interesting thing about interviewing celebrities, especially during all my time at Hello Magazine, which is very much a celebrity sort of, you know, voice. So it's a combination of going in and trying to get the best out of a celebrity, which if they have a bad day or they've just broken up with their boyfriend or maybe a film's gone badly or the previous person's treated them really badly, you have to work really hard to try and get something out of somebody. So you do have to be very on your game. But doing it on print and paper is so much easier than doing it on camera, because on print and paper, you can make a whole story around they were late and they'd had a heartbreak and stuff like that. Doing it on camera is the most nerve-wracking thing I ever do in my job, without a doubt. Because as I said, literally you could get, I've interviewed certain celebrities 3 or 4 times when they've been signed to big beauty companies. One day they can be sweet and one day they can be sour.
Yeah, no, that makes so much sense. And I'm a huge Beyonce fan over here, by the way. So I'm glad that you mentioned her.
My queen.
Yeah, she's on the cover of Vogue this month, British Vogue. And yeah. I feel like she's just the definition of evolvement as a woman. Like, here she is again, evolving again. You know, they're talking about her new album that's coming out, and just everything just feels like new and fresh. And I mean, she's insane.
I've seen a lot of live acts in my time, and I've seen people who can sing, like Barbara Streisand, and I saw, oh my God, Liza Minnelli and people like that. And I've seen people who can dance, right? Oh, try and find somebody that can do that live, both of them, stay fit, not lose their voice, not lose their breath, write their songs. I can go back a long time now, but I genuinely think she's the greatest live performer, female performer of all time. Yeah. I'm biased. I love her.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm with you. So we've talked a little bit about your background as a journalist, more traditional media. I'd love to sort of talk about your transition to what you're doing now on all your digital platforms. I mean, you are a beauty influencer, digital authority now. Can you talk to us? Was there like a moment where, or a time period where you took the jump and you were like, okay, this is the way I need to pivot. This is the way I need to go now.
I'll be really honest with you. I had a friend that was working actually at Maybelline in the States in PR. She is American, but I've known her. She was in London for about 20 years, and then she went back because her husband was in the States. And she came over one day. She's a real Anglophile, and she took me out for lunch, and she said, you genuinely realize, obviously, that the States are 3 or 4 years ahead of the UK. And she said to me, there's a revolution coming. I basically do all of my PR and marketing and content creation online now. What are you going to do about this, Nadine? And she was right. At the time, magazines were doing okay. They weren't doing brilliantly, but they were doing okay. And it sort of sat in the back of my head, and I knew what she was talking about. But at my age, I was really recalcitrant to change. And my only regret is that I didn't do it at that moment. And I probably left it a couple of years. Like, I went online and I bought all the kit and I bought the camera and I bought the lights and they gathered dust. And really one other British beauty editor was doing it, but she was doing it purely on Instagram. Nobody was doing it on YouTube. And I think I remember creating my first video. I remember having a big party and the whole industry supporting me. But it was very much a sort of, yeah, we'll see if you can do it. I realize now. And honestly, having worked for the Mail, having worked for BBC, having worked for ITV, having worked for Marie Claire, having worked for the Times, you are protected under this umbrella of this incredibly powerful corporation. And to actually go out as Nadine Baggott on my own, I'll be really honest with you, it's quite good to be naive, because it took me a long time to get those first 10,000 followers and that first 20,000 followers and that first 30. At some points, it felt like I was standing at the edge of the Grand Canyon screaming into the abyss. Nobody was listening. And that is quite, that's quite shocking when you've already had a platform. I've already stood on the shoulder of giants, but to stand on my own 2 feet was a big deal. And then it is literally like a snowball, you know, building bit, and then it suddenly goes. And then Instagram came along, and originally it was a photo for sharing platform, and I was never that bothered about it. You know, I quite liked it, but I'm not a selfie queen. You know, nobody's going to follow me because I'm young and pretty and all those sorts of things. As soon as it became a video platform, that's when my content engaged, because nobody's going to watch me because of the way I look. They watch me because of what I say. So So then, and then it made complete sense. And then suddenly it all came together. And it was very interesting. I was still working at Hello. I'd done all this in my spare time. So I'd worked probably one day a week. And then I worked every Sunday for about 2 or 3 years, putting up content and stuff like that. And then what happened was a gentleman came up to me at an event, a guy called Dom Smales, who was the founder of Gleam, who at the time were the biggest global digital agency representing digital talent. And he came up to me and he tapped me on the shoulder and he said, I'm keeping an eye on you. You're really interesting. And I said, me? I think at the time, honestly, I had 35,000 YouTube followers, like nobody. And he said, what you're doing is really interesting. And I said, thank you. He said, you should come in and see me. And I said, it's too soon. I can't come in and see you. And he said, no, you should come in and see me. And I didn't actually. I waited probably another year and a half. I probably still only have 50,000 followers on YouTube and maybe 30 on Instagram. But he's no longer with Gleam, but he's an incredibly clever man because he could see a niche in the market was that genuinely nobody was doing it with my background at my age, with my experience. So he was ahead of the curve. And then I went in there a year and a half later and they signed me and then I haven't really looked back.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible. And my next question, I think I know the answer, but I'd love for you to give us your perspective. Like, do you feel like it's never too late to jump on any of these platforms and sort of revamp?
No, it's never too late. It's never too late. I feel like there are two things that are missing from all of the platforms. There's expertise is missing, which is why all those derms are going crazy on TikTok and crazy.
Yes.
Because they know what they're talking about. But I think in terms of the demographic that's missing, it's actually older than me. So I have friends. I have one friend in particular who's a BBC journalist and DJ and radio presenter. She's doing really well. And you can see her numbers starting to grow. But I actually feel that just as I would say to, and in fact, I was on a trip last week, I would say to any young Black journalists and Asian journalists that we need you. There needs to be representation. I would also say the same to older men and women. My Instagram is skewing a little bit older every single day. And I think as young people move on to TikTok, Instagram is becoming much more 35 to 45, maybe even 45 to 55. That audience is loyal. They have a lot of spending power. They're kind. They're considerate. They don't troll you. They're our heartland. And it's very interesting. And I say to them, you know, if I can do it at 54, please, 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 if you feel that Instagram or YouTube doesn't reflect you back, create your own content. You've got nothing to lose by doing it, especially if you enjoy doing it. And it is quite an enjoyable thing to do. So I would say the future of YouTube would probably, that niche market would probably 50s, 60s, and maybe even people in their 70s. I mean, look at my Musk. I mean, these women are incredible and they're finding their power and their voice at that age.
I love it. Such good points. And it feels really, really empowering. So thank you for sharing all of that.
Genuinely, Emily, if I could say one thing, my only regret in life is that I didn't do it sooner.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And for anybody out there listening to this who's thinking they might want to do what I do or they have a particular skill set, it could be anything from flower arranging to quilting to gardening to hairstyling to makeup to any, whatever your skill set is. Please don't wait for your first bit of content to be perfect. Nobody is going to judge you. Just do it now. Do it. Get over yourself. Mm-hmm. Get over the sort of that awful cringe factor of thinking, who wants to listen to me? If there's an audience out there, you will find it. And I do think that expertise and niche expertise is the future for so many influencers. I mean, you know, I'm at an agency with Mrs. Hinch, you know, the woman that made millions selling cleaning stuff. Who ever thought that would happen 5 years ago?
Yeah, it's so true.
Crazy, right?
Well, you guys have heard it here first. So thank you so much for that. So to talk about your content a little bit, your YouTube, your Instagram, what type of content are you typically known for? And like, what are your audiences coming to you for?
Most generally, it's skincare advice. And also, I'm that person who really champions high street products. So one of the things I've learned in the 32 years of being a beauty journalist is that more expensive doesn't equal better. And I might not have been able to say that 10 years ago, but with the advent of companies like The Ordinary and The Inky List and Deciem and the wonderful Brandon Truex, who's sadly no longer with us, there has been a revolution in high street beauty. And Now, there's absolutely no reason, probably with maybe one or two exceptions, why you should be spending a lot of money on your beauty routine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love your perspective on beauty, by the way. You really are sort of no BS when it comes to beauty. And I saw this firsthand, I guess it was about a month ago at the Beauty Uncovered event, which was, for audiences that don't know, Beauty Uncovered is a massive skin aesthetics and beauty aesthetics expo here in London, bringing together top experts. And Nadine, I saw you hosting panels and teams of experts and really got to see you in action, which was really fun. But I guess to give our audience just like a baseline, what is your general perspective and approach when it comes to the beauty industry here in London, I guess globally too?
I mean, I think there's part of me that I've gone through different cycles in my career. And I think when I was young, I was sort of like a wide-eyed, enthusiastic little puppy, sort of, you know, trying to hump the leg of the beauty industry, because I was so happy to be in this industry. And as I got older, I've become a lot more reflective, a lot more questioning, and a lot more skeptical. I'm not cynical, but I'm definitely skeptical. And also the other thing I've learned as I got older is, you know, I've tried it. I've been there, seen it, done it. I've got the t-shirt. God, I know what works. I also know what doesn't work. And it drives me mad. And I was one of those people, but it drives me mad when like women in their 20s give anti-aging advice or, you know, talk about plumping fine lines. It makes me want to scream. It makes me want to put my hands through the screen and say, for God's sake, just enjoy being young. You're never going to be as young and as beautiful as you are now. Don't worry about it. So the advantage of youth is that the advantage of getting older is that it just gives you a different perspective on life and on the journey of being told so many, I shan't say lies, but myths of the beauty industry. So I'm absolutely determined to save my followers from spending lots of money on a product that doesn't work, on a treatment that doesn't work, when they can do something themselves at home, especially at the moment. You know, we're in a global cost of living crisis. And so I think my content is, if you are going to buy beauty products, never more important than it is now.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess on a similar note, when we're talking about aging, do you have any tips, no matter, I guess, what age range you're in?
Yes. The biggest tip I'm ever going to say to you, and trust me, if you could see me now, you'd realize that I do have a tan because I've just got back from Ibiza, which is so naughty of me. I did wear an SPF 50, but I didn't apply it often enough or frequent enough. You really do. I'm not absolutely prescriptive about wearing an SPF every single day. Most of us live in London. The weather is bloody dire 9 months of the year. I mean, it's pretty awful. I don't even leave the house. But I do think don't sunbathe, don't go on sunbeds. If you are going to sit in the sun, you know, I literally have worn an SPF most days down to here and then stupidly forgot my chest. And as a result, my chest is sun damaged and I have to have laser work on it and IPL work on it and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, the first thing you can do is don't sunbathe. Don't chase a tan. It's crazy. And then the second thing is the only things you really genuinely only things you need to spend a decent amount of money on are your retinol and your vitamin C. Everything else should be budget. Everything else. And don't throw money away on cleansers or moisturizers or hydrating serums or hyaluronic acid or anything like that. Don't fall for big names. Don't fall for obscure ingredients picked by virgins up a mountain at like Dawn and all that sort of stuff that some huge French company is trying to sell you. It's all BS and marketing. If you have the money, go for it. If you love beautiful packaging, if you love cellophane and rich boxes and little designer spoons, go for it. It's actually not going to make your skin any better. The most important thing you do is don't sunbathe. Don't go on sunbeds. I mean, I've never smoked, so definitely don't smoke. But the most important things is to spend your money wisely on the things that actually work. And for me, the things that work are clinically proven active ingredients, which would be vitamins. So vitamin A, which is the retinol, vitamin C, you know, vitamin B3, niacinamide, something like that. And then the rest of it, all the sort of humectants, conditioners, skin cleansers, that's all pretty mass market, really.
Yeah. Such great tangible tips. I'm on your wavelength and SPF is king. We have another follow-up question later on that one. So talking a little bit
too closely at this Ibiza tan. Can I just say, one of your questions was, have you ever had a beauty disaster? The only reason my hair is up is because I just washed and blow dried my hair. In fact, I dyed my roots for you, and then I washed and blow dried my hair, and I put far too much hair oil in my hair. Look at this. It's gone all really stringy and oily at the end. I'm going to have to wash it again. That's my fault.
That's your beauty faux pas today.
That's just today's beauty faux pas, Emily. There are many. I'm here to make the mistake so you don't have to.
No, I love it. But hey, I'm on the same page as you. I was in Greece last week, and I'm usually like overly cautious with the sun, and I'm also pregnant, so I have to be extra careful. I have a full tan. My back is very tan because I also feel like as a mom, like it's the last thing that comes to mind is me trying to get someone else put SPF on my back. So I have an extremely tanned back at the moment.
But this is really interesting. So I absolutely love body sprays. I had the La Roche-Posay Hyaluron B5 gel to here, but I love those body sprays. They're so good. So many people make really good ones. And I particularly love the HelioCare one. And I had an SPF 50, but the thing is, you need 4 or 5 passes and you need to keep reapplying it. And I was on holiday. If I was on holiday with my boyfriend, I'd be religious. I was on holiday with girlfriends. We were day drinking. I forgot. So I'd apply it and then we'd gossip and I never lie in the sun. So I'm under a huge umbrella with a huge hat. And then suddenly the sun's moved across and you've forgotten to reapply your SPF because I was having so much fun.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, hey, we do the best we can.
We do the best we can.
So talking about skin aesthetics, I'm sure this is a loaded question, but a couple quick ones. What's important to look for? And is there anything that you have absolutely loved that you would want to share with the audience that you've had done?
I am always really honest and open about any aesthetic work I've had done. Let's go back to the celebrities. It drives me bonkers that celebrities lie about the work they have done. I think it's so unfeminist. It's so disempowering to women to say, it's just water and exercise, and you can see they've got a face full of work. I just find it so disempowering and really disingenuous of women to lie to other women like that. So genuinely, I have not had any work done for 10 or 11 months, purely by accident. And I'm desperately trying to get in to see Alexis Granite, my dermatologist, to have a little bit of baby Botox. But actually, as I got older, I've had less and less work. My face, I've got a very big Eastern European face. So actually, fillers don't sit well in my face. Fillers tend to work much better on very slim, delicate faces. I'm not a slim, delicate person. I'm nearly 6 foot tall. So I don't actually need filler, although I did have a little bit of lip filler about 3 years ago just to replace some volume. And I would absolutely recommend beautiful, subtle lip work done. Dr. Harris does the best in the UK. I can give you all the links afterwards. I am a complete Botox fan. However, I don't like, and there's nothing wrong with it, that I don't like the Kardashian immobile face. It's beautiful on a young Kardashian woman, but when you're my age, if you completely paralyze the forehead, it doesn't match the lower face. And I have a very expressive daytime TV face. So I like little micro droplets just through my face, just to soften the lines. And now this is going to be really shocking to you. Everything else I've tested, and I have tested Altherapy, and I've tested Morpheus 8, and I've tested... I do like a little bit of IPL for sun damage and pigmentation. Everything else, the results are so minimal for the money you spend. Mm-hmm. It shocks me how much the aesthetic industry sort of cons you into that stuff. Wow. I mean, when they say it lifts the face, mm-hmm. You have to look at the before and after so carefully. And I follow so many amazing, amazing aesthetic doctors and dermatologists and surgeons on Instagram. I love them. And every time I see a before and after that I look at, I think, wow, that's impressive. It's always a deep plane facelift, especially when you get to my age. I'm 60 next week. So, you know, hey, there comes a point where you're going to have to go under the knife, and no judgment for anybody that does it. Each to their own, your body, your choice, you know. I actually did have a lower blepharoplasty, which is the fat pads removed from under my eyes, when I was 35. So 25 years ago now. Was one of the best things I ever did. And I did it because I was on television the whole time and I always looked tired. And so actually they did it from the inside. So they just laser the inside and scoop the fat pads out. It has left me now at this age slightly hollow. And I have actually spoken. I'll tell you a funny story. I went to see Dr. Paul Nassif the other day to interview him professionally. He's the doctor from Botched. And I'm a huge fan. He's the kindest, nicest man. And I was talking about having a possible upper and lower eye job done at my age. And he said to me, he was so funny. He said, "I don't really think you need it, Nadine." I said, "Really?" And I said, "Look, I'm going to go and take my makeup off." So I went into the loo and I took my makeup off and I lit myself from above so he could see it. And he went, "Yeah, I see what you mean." He said, "But aren't you worried about this? You could have a lower facelift, Nadine." Genuinely not offended, because he's literally looking at my face with Hollywood standards. And he's right. You know, if I lived in Hollywood, I would need a lower facelift. I adore him. Absolutely no judgment at all. And then he said to me, "Come out, I'll do it all for free and we'll do a video." I have not booked my flight. I'm a little bit of a scaredy cat when it comes to things like that.
No, but I don't blame you. I mean, that's super, super interesting. So it sounds like for you, baby Botox, a bit of a more natural look is where you're at.
And also genuinely, I've seen filler do amazing things on, and I've seen it performed live on really, really slim faces. It's just not for everybody. There is not a one size fits all for everything. And can I just say to everybody listening to this, if you hear somebody banging on about some treatment they've had that's been absolutely amazing, if they haven't paid for it, don't believe a word any of these people say. Because genuinely, I'm not naming names, but I have friends in their late 40s who are journalists who just go from treatment to treatment to treatment to treatment and then write features about it. They don't pay for any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, you've got to pay your hard-earned cash. And if I lost my job tomorrow, I would buy C-Ferulic Vitamin C. Mm-hmm. I would buy Medicate Retinaldehyde or a 1% retinol from a really good company. Everything else would come from Boots and Superdrug. I would pay for baby Botox and a little bit of lip filler.
Yeah.
Everything else, I'm sorry, it's got to be proven to be more efficient than it is now and more effective than it is now. I am so skeptical.
Absolutely. No, but I appreciate that perspective. I think we need a little bit more of that. So I appreciate that. I guess switching gears a little, like, what's the beauty routine looking like for you? Are we heavy on skincare, a little bit of makeup? Like, what's that like for you?
My skincare is virtually almost different products week to week because it's my job to test products. But the foundations of my skincare are always, always the same. So in the morning, I have a rinse off gel cleanser, something pH balanced, non-foaming, because you're literally getting rid of the skincare from the night before. Mm-hmm. Then absolutely a vitamin C serum, and I do like a minimum 10 or 15% L-ascorbic acid, and my gold standard is C-Ferulic from SkinCeuticals. I understand it's expensive, and there are other high street alternatives out there. Then it would be probably a hydrating serum. I do like something with niacinamide in. Then it would be an SPF with moisturizer. So it could either be, in the winter, I would choose a moisturizer with an SPF 30. In summer, I would use a dedicated SPF. And then I skip the moisturizer because I don't like gunky, tacky feeling. Mm-hmm. Then my makeup. And then at night, a rinse off cream cleanser with some sort of cloth, because that obviously has to get rid of all the makeup. And I love lots of liner and mascara and all that mm-hmm. sort of stuff. And then at night, straight in with some sort of retinoid. So I would start at a 1% retinol, but I've been used to it. Most people, I would recommend a 0.3% retinol. And there are some amazing high street ones out at the moment. The Boots number 7 range is incredible. Olay have got some really nice stuff. Again, this stuff wasn't available a few years ago. But really, you want to start aiming at a 1%, and then you're getting into Paula's Choice territory, and then you're onto retinaldehydes, which is Medicate. I'm generally not a huge fan of prescription tretinoin, but I know lots of people are, and it's absolutely the gold standard. But for me, as a content creator videoing every single day, I've never really got used to that continual pill, that sort of rolling off of skin. However, if I was a normal person, I'd try it. And those prescription services like Dermatica and Skin and Me are incredible if you have a skin problem. I don't really think they work for aging, but if you have advanced sun damage, melasma, acne, rosacea, they're incredible because they're going to give you the access to a dermatologist online and dermatologist prescribed actives that are proven to work that we just can't get in the UK. You know, I interviewed a dermatologist the other day, and I'm genuinely friends with so many of them. 0.2% of the population in the UK can access a dermatologist. It's not the same in the States. It's not the same in Canada. It's not the same in other countries. Mm-hmm. So we have a chronic shortage, and most NHS dermatologists are working with people with chronic eczema, dermatitis, psoriasis, skin cancers. they're not going to worry about your wrinkles and your melasma. They're just not. They're too busy almost saving lives. So, you know, that's why I am a huge fan of Dermatica and Skin and Me. I do think they're really clever. I think they overly push the trep for people like me who don't really have problematic skin. I'm very lucky at my age. But otherwise, I think if you've got a skin problem, they're a good go-to solution.
Makes sense. Well, thankfully, there's so many, I guess, educational influencers and beauty authorities like you, we can get our information from. But right, we just have to be so on top of educating ourselves as consumers now. It's insane.
Do you know the interesting thing about my DMs is if somebody sends me a picture, I can pretty much, if I tap on it at my age now, it's not going to be some unsolicited man. It's going to be somebody with going, look at this rash. What's this? What do I do about this?
Oh my gosh.
And I do try. And I try because I know how hard it is even to get in to see a GP, let alone to see a GP and make a referral to a dermatologist. And there are some amazing dermatologists that I regularly create content with who are just our friends and who are incredible. It's going to cost you a lot of money.
Yeah.
Not cheap.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you've named a few really great high street budget-friendly skincare buys. And this is obviously something that you're really known for from a content perspective. Are there any other budget beauty buys for, I guess, makeup, hair, or anything that you are like constantly grabbing for? Or they're your holy grails?
So in terms of skincare, I'm a huge CeraVe fan. I love some of the Inkey List. I love some of the Ordinary. Sally Hughes's new range for Superdrug with Revolution has got some amazing products in it. Genuinely, the sort of belt and braces, sort of good cotton underwear of skincare. Think of it like that.
Yeah.
You don't have to spend money on. You know, so if you're gonna buy a great pair of tights and a great pair of hose or a great pair of underwear and a good cotton bra or a good cotton slip, that's your basic skincare you save the money on. And then, you know, maybe a little bit of money on a little black dress and then your money on a handbag, which would be vitamin C and retinol. So think of it like that. In terms of makeup, do you know, it's really interesting. It took me probably until about 15 years ago to realize that all makeup comes from about 5 companies in the world. And it's truly shocking when you realize this. So there's a company called Intercos in Italy that does all of the eyeshadow palettes, you know, makes everything from Tom Ford and Armani to Charlotte Tilbury to Marks and Spencers. You know, there's one factory in Germany that makes pretty much all the eyeliners. So what you end up paying for is you, if you're going to spend your money on makeup, you're paying for new technology because the expensive brands will obviously get the new pigment, the new shimmer, whatever first. And then you're paying for really great packaging. But once it's on your face, who's really going to know the difference? Mm-hmm. So, for example, there are some amazing dupes out there for the Chanel bronzing cream from companies like W7, e.l.f., their little mini trios and quartets. I'm not a huge, back in the day, I loved a Naked, an Urban Decay Naked palette, but the truth is you only use 4 shadows from it, right? So
totally.
Avoid buying a palette unless you're young and you're having fun and you want to look like something out of Euphoria, and good on you if you do. The vast majority of adults, I probably wear the same 4 MAC and Bobbi Brown shadows day after day after day, or I use my bronzer on my eyes, so I have today. So I'm a huge fan of e.l.f. I'm a huge fan of some of the Revolution dupes. I'm a huge fan of W7. I think once it's on your face, can anybody really tell any difference? And my absolutely top tip, even though I am obsessed with Charlotte Tilbury's Pillow Talk push-up lashes, which I have on today and I love, is I love a budget mascara. I mean, I die for a Maybelline or a Rimmel or a Max Factor. That's where it's at. And actually, even in the last year and a half, the budget brands, shockingly, they don't come in enough shades, and there's no excuse for that. But the budget brands are even moving into those really amazing skincare foundation hybrids. So L'Oreal Paris did one. Maybelline have got one. Max Factor have got one. They are beautiful. I mean, like, they're proper Laura Mercier, Giorgio Armani type beautiful.
Yeah.
And if I was to pass one bit of advice onto anybody who wants to be a really conscious, savvy beauty consumer, is go away and Google the big beauty companies, the big beauty corporations and the brands they own. So what you'll end up with is you'll end up with a Venn diagram. If you remember a Venn diagram from when you were at school, so you'll have a big bubble with Estee Lauder companies and then all the brands they own. And you have a big bubble with L'Oreal and all the brands they own, and a big bubble with Unilever and all the other companies. And if you think that those companies don't share technology and share factories, you're a fool. Like, the packaging will be different, but absolutely, you know that if they're making a lipstick for Lancôme, they're also making it for L'Oreal Paris. It won't be in as nice bullet. It might not smell the same, but basically it's all sourced, because the power within those companies comes from the huge buy. So they actually conglomerate their brands. So for example, La Roche-Posay is owned by L'Oreal. It has the brand new UV Immune UVA filter, which is the long-lasting UVA filter. So it's better for the skin because it's the UVA rays that harm the skin and cause the low-dose aggressive aging, the inflammaging. La Roche-Posay will have that exclusively for maybe a year or two. You can pretty much guarantee that's going to appear in Lancôme in 2 years' time, and then it'll be in Garnier. I mean, and then it'll come down to L'Oreal Paris, and it just will appear, because that's, if they've invested that much money in making, and it costs millions to make a new UV filter, they have to recoup that money. And it's the same with a new pigment from a new factory or a new active ingredient or a new stabilized form of vitamin C. If one company has it within a huge umbrella, the others will trickle down. So go away, do yourself a favor and Google. You'll be gobsmacked how big those corporations are.
No, absolutely. It's super, super interesting. And you've named many of my favorites, and, you know, on the High Street Max Factor, right? Some of their makeup buys, they truly feel like luxury products. Like, their hyaluronic acid, like, foundation came out, and it was just good.
So good. I actually worked with them on that, but I'm not biased at all. And I went in it really skeptically, and I put it on, and I just thought, honestly, if you didn't know, if you tested that blind, you would not think that wasn't Laura Mercier or Armani.
Yeah.
Absolutely gorgeous. And I think that's been the final hurdle. I think skincare's been democratized. I think makeup's been duped and democratized. But that skincare makeup hybrid, like those foundations that are super lightweight and blend beautifully, they just need to do them in more shades.
Yeah. Exactly.
That tends to be where they save their money. Like, they do it in five shades and they go, oh, it covers everybody. No, it doesn't.
Right. Absolutely. Well, Nadine, we're down to our last couple of questions. We've covered so much with you.
I loved talking to you, Emily.
It's been such a blast. Likewise. I guess, what's a last word of wisdom or advice you want to leave our audience with? It can be anything you want.
Don't be afraid to jump. Even if you can't see what you're jumping into, it's genuinely never too late. I'm living proof. I wish more people in their 60s and 70s who are older than me would just start creating content. I find it incredibly empowering. You can, there's a line within the inclusivity movement that you can only be what you see. So you can't be what you can't see. So it might, for example, speak to a young Black girl who is having trouble coping with her hair because all Disney princesses have long, blonde or shiny, straight hair. And it's heartbreaking. I have a really good friend whose daughter cut off her own hair when she was about 4 because she didn't like her hair. So we need more images that show yourself Black, reflect yourself back on your best day. Mm-hmm. And I would say the same at my end of the spectrum. So you need more women in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s who are empowered, who are together, who are articulate or intelligent, who are wise. They don't necessarily have to look amazing, but if they look amazing, that's even better. So it's never too late, and don't be afraid to take risks. It's the risks that will pay off. If you don't ask, the answer is always no.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And Nadine, what is next for you? Is there anything exciting coming up or any content we should be looking out for?
You know, the weirdest thing is I'm back on This Morning tomorrow. How strange is that? I've not been on This Morning for about 4 years and I got a call out of the blue. What's coming next for me? I'm about to move house. So I'm moving out of London for the first time in, my goodness, 42 years. I'm not moving that far away. So you'll notice that I'm suddenly I've got a little bit more space to film in. You can see behind me now, everybody recognizes this room. Look at that beauty cupboard. Oh my God, it's absolutely stacked. I'll be
cleaning
that out for beauty bags. But otherwise, I think, just carrying on what I'm doing, as I said, I'm 60 next week. So carrying on what I'm doing in my 60s, hopefully being an inspiration to young people that realize that getting older is not scary. It can be really empowering and fun. And you don't need to become like this sort of cliched image of some little old lady. And then I'm happy. I mean, all I need is for somebody to slide into my DMs and say that I've cleared up their dermatitis, or their son's acne's cleared up, or they've finally learned how to make up their hooded eye or dye their own roots. That's me happy, Emily.
Yeah. Yeah. And for Nadine, so for people who don't already follow you, where can everyone find you, follow you, your YouTube channel, everything?
Well, you know, the funny thing about having the strangest name in the world is there is genuinely only one Nadine Baggott. So it's NadineBaggott. You'll find me on YouTube. You'll find me on Instagram. You'll find me on Twitter. Strangely, I'm on TikTok, but I didn't create that account. My manager did. They're desperate to get me on TikTok and pointing at things. I'm not sure.
Totally.
Probably I'll speak to you in a couple of years' time. You know what I'll say, Emily? I wish I'd done TikTok. Yeah. I should take my own advice. And what I try to do genuinely is I try to answer every question. So I love it. I will answer DMs, obviously, but I love it when people ask questions below any of my content, because then if I answer, everybody can then find the answer and network. And it's a big, supportive, happy family of followers.
Yeah, I love that. Well, I have a feeling we're going to be seeing you on TikTok like next week. So thank you so much. This was a blast.
Can I just say, Emily, if for your notes you want the picture of me and Beyonce, where genuinely she's looking like, please, security, take this woman away, I'll send it to you. It's hilarious.
Yes, yes please. Absolutely. Okay. Nadine, you're an inspo. Thank you so much. This was so fun. And we can't wait to keep up with you further. So thanks again for coming on.
Thank you, Emily. Bye.
Thank you guys so much for listening and watching. If you found any value from this episode, please share it with a friend. Tag us on Instagram at The Big Move Podcast and at Monday Network. We love to hear your feedback, and we will catch you next time.